If there's only one. She merely held his gaze. Gansey, Adam said. She closed her eyes. Of course he would be taken from them. His mind supplied the image. Gansey convulsing on the ground, covered in blood. Ronan crumpled beside him in grief. It had been months since Cave's water showed him the vision, but he had not forgotten it. Nor had he forgotten how, in the vision, it had been Adam's fault. His heart was a grave. If it's your fault, Adam thought, you can stop it. 26. Blue woke up angry. She didn't remember what she dreamt, only that it was about her mother, and when she woke up, she could have hit something. She remembered when she had visited Adam one afternoon that summer and he'd kicked a box. That was how angry she was. Only it didn't seem to be worth kicking anything when there wasn't anyone around to see her do it. She lay there and told herself to go back to sleep, but instead, she got angrier. She was tired of Persephone and Calla and her mother withholding information because Blue wasn't psychic. Of not being able to daydream of fancy colleges because she wasn't rich. Of not being able to hold Gansey's hand because they couldn't hurt Adam's feelings and not being able to kiss Gansey's mouth because she didn't want to kill him. She was tired of knowing that he was going to die and being afraid that her mother would too. Over and over she heard Adam guess the truth. Gansey. She threw off her blankets and angrily got dressed and angrily stormed into the phone room. Orla sat there painting her nails at 1 o'clock in the morning. Blue froze in the doorway, intention written on her face. What? Orla said. Go ahead. Blue didn't move. Oh, please, I'm not going to stop you. I was just trying to keep you from breaking your heart. But whatever, go do it, Orla said. Blue stepped across the room and picked up the phone, glancing at Orla again suspiciously. Her cousin had returned to painting tiny mandalas on her nails. She didn't pretend not to be listening, but looked otherwise untroubled. Blue called Gansey. He picked up at once. I wasn't sleeping. I know, she replied. Come get me. There was something unfamiliar about him when he arrived in the pig. Something ferocious about his eyes. Some sort of bite in his faint smile. Something altogether hectic and unsettled. She stood on the ledge of his smile and looked over the edge. This wasn't the Gansey she'd seen in the kitchen earlier. This was the Gansey she secretly called at night. He didn't ask where she wanted to go. They were not allowed to speak of this, so they said nothing at all. The Camaro idled on the silent late-night street. She climbed in and slammed the door. Gansey, heedless, wild Gansey, tore into another gear as soon as they were out of the neighborhood. He sent the car hurtling from stoplight to stoplight, and then, when he got to the empty highway, he let the car frantically climb in speed, his hand a fist over the gear shift. They were driving east toward the mountains. Blue turned on the radio and messed with Gansey's music until she found something worth playing loudly. Then she wrestled down her window so that the air screamed over her. It was too cold for that, really, but Gansey reached in the back seat without taking his eyes off the road and dragged his overcoat to the front. She put it on, shivering, when the silk lining chilled her bare legs. The collar smelled of him. They didn't speak. The radio tripped and waltzed. The car roared. The wind buffeted inside the cab. Blue put her hand on top of Gansey's and held it, white-knuckled. There wasn't another soul on the road but them. They drove to the mountains, up, up, and through the pass. The peaks were black and forbidding in the half-light of the headlights, and when they reached the very highest point in the pass, Gansey's fingers tightened beneath hers as he downshifted and hurtled the car around a U-turn back the way they had come. They sped back to Henrietta, past eerily vacant parking lots of shops, past silent townhomes, past Aglenby, past downtown, past Henrietta. At the other side of town, he slid around a corner to the new, unused bypass. Four pristine lanes of streetlight-lined road from nowhere to nowhere. He pulled over here, and he took his coat from her, and they switched places. She slid the seat up as close to the wheel as it would go and stalled the car and stalled it again. He put his hand on her knee, fingers on skin, lifeline touching bone, and kept her from letting the clutch out too quickly. The engine revved, strong and sure, and the car surged forward. They didn't speak. The street light striped through the windshield as she made a pass up one side of the road, then turned and went the other way, again and again. The car was fearsome and willing, too much, too fast, everything all at once. The gear shift knocked under her fist when they were still, and the gas pedal stuck and then surged when they were moving. Cool air from an underdash vent whispered night air over her bare legs. Heat from the thrumming engine burned the tops of her feet. The sound alone was a monster, amplified when she could feel it vibrating in the gear shift, tugging at the steering wheel, roaring through her feet. She was afraid of it until she hit the gas, and then her heart was pounding too hard to remember being afraid. The Camaro was like Gansey tonight, terrifying and thrilling, willing to do whatever she asked. She was bolder with each turn. For all its noise and posturing, the pig was a generous teacher. It did not mind that Blue was a very short girl who had never driven a stick before. It did what it could. She could not forget Gansey's hand on her knee. She pulled over. She had thought it was such a simple thing to avoid kissing someone when she'd been with Adam. Her body had never known what to do. Now it knew. Her mouth didn't care that it was cursed. She turned to Gansey. Blue, he warned, but his voice was chaotic. This close, his throat was scented with mint and wool sweater and vinyl car seat. And Gansey, just Gansey. She said, I just want to pretend. I want to pretend that I could. He breathed out. What was a kiss without a kiss? It was a tablecloth tugged from beneath the party service. Everything jumbled against everything else in just a few chaotic moments. Fingers in hair, hands cupping necks, mouths dragged on cheeks and chins in dangerous proximity. They stopped, noses mashed against each other in the strange way that closeness required. She could feel his breath in her mouth. Maybe it wouldn't hurt if I kiss you, he whispered. Maybe it's only if you kiss me. They both swallowed at the same time, and the spell was broken. They both laughed, again at the same time, shakily. And then we never speak of it again, Gansey said, mocking himself softly, and Blue was so glad of it because she had played the words from that night over and over in her mind and wanted to know he had too. Gently he tucked her hair behind her ears. This was a fool's errand because it had never been behind her ears to begin with and wouldn't stay. But he did it again and again, and then he took out two mint leaves and put one in his mouth and one in hers. She couldn't tell if it was very late or if it had become very early. And now the catastrophic joy was wearing off and reality was sinking back in. She could see now that he was very nearly that boy that she'd seen in the churchyard. Tell him. She rolled the mint leaf over and over her tongue. She felt shivery with cold or fatigue. Did you ever think of stopping before you found him? She asked. He looked bemused. Don't give me that face, she said. I know that you have to find him. I'm not asking you to tell me why. I get that. But as it gets riskier, have you ever thought of stopping? He held her gaze, but his eyes had gone far away, pensive. He was weighing it, maybe, the cost of this quest versus his undying need to see his king. Then he was focused on her again. He shook his head. She slouched back and sighed big enough to make her lips go, brrrr. Well, okay. Are you afraid? Is that what you're asking? Don't be stupid, she replied. It's okay if you are, Gansey said. This is only mine in the end. And I don't expect anyone else. Don't be stupid. It was ridiculous. She didn't even know if it was the search for Glendower that would kill him. Any old hornet would do. She couldn't tell him. Mora was right. It would just ruin the days he had left. Adam was right, too. They needed to find Glendower and ask for Gansey's life. But how could she know this huge thing about him and not tell him? We should go back. Now he exhaled, but he didn't disagree. The clock in the Camaro didn't work, but it had to be dangerously close to morning. They switched places. Blue curled again in his coat, feet up on the seat. As she tugged the collar up to cover her mouth and nose, she let herself imagine that this place was rightfully hers, that somehow Adam and Ronan already knew and were already okay with it, that her lips carried no threat, that Gansey was not going to die, that he wasn't going to leave for Yale or Princeton, that all that mattered was that he had given her his coat with its sweetgrass and mint on the collar. As they headed back into downtown, they spotted a shiny vehicle, undoubtedly a Raven Boy car, pulled over by the side of the road. It was glittering and astronomical in the streetlights. The ugly feeling of reality nudged Blue again. "What's this?" Gansey said. "One of yours," she replied. Gansey pulled up alongside and motioned for Blue to roll down a window. An equally astronomical and glittering black-haired boy sat behind the wheel of the other car. "You're a chick," he said to her, puzzled. 20 points, Blue replied tensely. "Heck, have 30 because it's late and I'm feeling generous." "Chang, what's going on?" Gansey said, leaning forward to see past her. His voice had changed immediately to his Raven Boy one, which made Blue suddenly annoyed to be seen in a car with him. It was like her anger from before had not been properly extinguished, and now it only took the knowledge that she was a girl in a car with an Aglaby prince to reignite it. Henry Ching leapt out of his car to lean in the passenger window. Blue was distinctly uncomfortable to be this close to his sharp cheekbones. He said, "I don't know. It stopped." "Stopped how?" Gansey asked. Henry replied, "It made a noise. I stopped it. It seemed angry. I don't know. I don't want to die. I have my whole future ahead of me. Do you know anything about cars?" "Not electric ones. What kind of noise did you say it made?" "One I don't want to hear again. I can't break it. I broke the last one and my father was pissed." "Do you want to ride back?" "No, I want your phone. Mine's dead and I can't walk by the road or I'll get raped by the locals." Henry kneed the side of the Camaro and said, "Man, this is the way to do it. American muscle you can hear from a mile away. I'm not very good at this wasp thing. You, on the other hand, are a champion. Only I think you have it backward. It's supposed to be hanging with chicks during the day, boys at night. That's what my Halmani used to say anyway." There was something terrible about the entire exchange. Blue couldn't decide if it was because it didn't require her, or because it was between two extremely rich boys, or because it was a concrete reminder that she had broken one of her most important rules. Stay away from Aglaby boys. She felt like a dusty and ordinary accessory, or worse, she just felt bad. She mutely passed Gansey's phone to Henry. As the other boy returned to his shiny spacecraft to place the call, she said to Gansey, "I don't like when your voice sounds like that, FYI." "Like what?" She knew it wasn't nice to say it, but her mouth said it anyway. "Your fake voice." "I beg your pardon?" "The one you do with them," she said, "with the other Aglaby bastards." "Henry's all right," Gansey said. "Oh, whatever, raped by the locals?" "That was a joke. Ha, ha, ha. Ha, ha, ha. It's a joke when someone like him says it because he doesn't have to actually worry about it. It's just so typical." "I don't understand why you're being this way. He's actually a little like you." Blue scoffed. "Oh, ho!" She knew she was being over the top, but she couldn't seem to stop. It was just something about their handsome faces and handsome hair and handsome cars and easy confidence with one another. "I just think it's probably a good thing that we can't really. We'll never." "Oh, is it?" Gansey asked, dangerously polite. "Why is that?" "We're just not in the same place is all. We have very different priorities. We're too far apart. It wouldn't actually work." 2 seconds ago, we were nearly kissing," he said. "And now it's all off because we stopped to let a guy use my phone?" "It was never on." She felt as furious as she had when she first woke up, more. "Is this because I didn't agree that Henry was a bastard? I'm trying to see things from your point of view, but I'm having a very difficult time. Something about my voice. Never mind. Forget it. Just take me home, Blue said. Now she was really regretting everything. She wasn't even sure where her argument had taken her, only that now she couldn't back down. After he gives your phone back. Gansey studied her. She expected to see her anger mirrored on his face, but instead, his expression had cleared. It wasn't happy exactly, but he no longer looked confused. He asked, "When are you going to tell me what this is really about?" This made her heave a great shuddered breath that was close to tears. Never. 27. Gansey woke up in a terrible mood. He was still tired. He had lost hours of sleep to playing and replaying the events inside the car, trying to decide if he had been wrong or right or if it even mattered. And it was drizzling, and Mallory was whistling, and Noah was cracking pool balls against each other, and Ronan was pouring breakfast cereal from the box into his mouth, and Gansey's favorite yellow sweater smelled too doggy to bear another wearing, and the pig flooded and wouldn't start. And so now they were headed off to get Blue and Adam in the soulless Suburban and a brown sweater that looked exactly on the outside like Gansey felt on the inside. This cave wasn't going to be anything but a cave like they always were, so Gansey would have been fine staying in Monmouth for another 4 hours of sleep and doing it another day. "It might as well be whales out there with all this rain," Mallory said, not sounding very pleased about it. Beside him, Adam was silent, expression troubled in a way Gansey hadn't seen in a while. Blue, too, was sullenly quiet, with bags under her eyes to match Gansey's. Last night his coat collar had still been scented with her hair. Now he kept turning his head in hopes of catching it, but like everything else in the wretched day, it had gone muted and dusty. At the Ditley farm, Mallory, the dog, and Jesse settled in the house. Mallory, unhopeful, "I don't suppose you have any tea." Jesse,
"Do you want Earl Grey or Darjeeling?"
Mallory, "Oh, sweet heavens." And the teens trekked across the damp field to the cave. Adam asked, "Are you really bringing that bird into a cave?" "Yes, Parrish," Ronan replied, "I believe I am." There was no way to ask Blue about the night before. He was too dull-edged to analyze it anymore. He just wanted to know, were they still fighting? Gansey remained in a bad mood as they applied their caving equipment and checked and double-checked their flashlights. Blue had acquired a used set of coveralls from somewhere, and the sheer effort of not looking at her in them was taking what little concentration he could dredge up. This wasn't the way it was supposed to be, he thought. It wasn't supposed to be crammed in between school events and congressional tasks. It shouldn't have been a murky fall day too humid for the season. It should have been a day where he had slept enough to properly feel things. It wasn't supposed to be any of the things that it was, and instead, it was all of them. This was not, he thought as they descended, even how the cavern was supposed to look. Of course Glendower was underground. Of course Gansey had known that he would have to be buried. But somehow he had imagined it lighter. This was just a hole in the ground like the rest. Dirt walls pressing in close, clawed and chiseled out when they grew too narrow to admit a coffin. A rabbit hole, down and down. This was not how it had looked in his vision back when he'd stood in Caveswater's vision tree. But perhaps that hadn't been the truth. Here was the truth. They were looking right at it. "Stop it, Lynch," Adam said. He was at the back of the line. Ronan was right in front of him.
"Stop what?"
"Oh, come on." Ronan didn't reply. They kept walking. They'd only made it a few more yards, though, when Adam said, "Ronan, come on." They came to a slow and stuttering halt. Adam had stopped, and that had jerked Ronan to a stop, which had stopped Blue and then finally Gansey. Chainsaw flapped up, wings grazing the close cavern walls. She came to rest on Ronan's shoulder again, her head pitched low and wary. She frantically cleaned her beak on his shirt.
"What?"
Ronan demanded, flicking thumb and finger in the raven's direction.
"Singing," Adam said.
"I'm not doing anything."
Adam had his fingers pressed against one of his ears.
I know now. I know it's not you.
You think?
No, Adam said, voice thin. I know it's not you, because I'm hearing it in my deaf ear. A little chill scurried across Gansey's skin. What is it singing? Blue asked. Chainsaw's beak parted. In a trilling, sideways little voice, completely unlike her coarse raven voice, she sang, All maidens young and fair, listen to your fathers.
Stop that, Ronan shouted, not to Chainsaw, but to the cave.
But this was not Cave's water, and whatever it was did not attend to Ronan Lynch. Chainsaw kept singing, a feat made more terrible because she never closed her beak. It was as if she was merely a speaker for some sound inside herself.
The men of all his land, they listen to their fathers.
Ronan shouted again,
Whoever you are, stop that. She's mine.
Chainsaw broke off to laugh. It was a high, cunning laugh, as much a song as the song. Jesus Christ, Gansey said to hide the sound of every hair on his body standing up and both of his testicles retreating.
Chainsaw,
Ronan snapped. Her attention darted to him. She peered at him, head cocked, something unfamiliar and intense about her. She had gotten large, her inked feathers ruffled round her throat, her beak savage and expressive. Right then, it was impossible to forget that she was actually a dream creature, not a true raven, and that the workings of her mind were the same mysterious stuff of Ronan Lynch or of Caveswater. For a dreadful second, too fast for Gansey to say anything, he thought she was about to stab at Ronan with that fierce beak of hers. But she merely clicked her beak, and then she took flight down the passage ahead of them.
Chainsaw! Ronan called, but she disappeared into the black. Damn it! Untie me!
No, Adam and Blue said at once. No, agreed Gansey firmer. I don't even know if we should keep going. I'm not interested in feeding ourselves to a cave. Chainsaw's defection felt wrong, too. Turned sideways somehow, or inside out, everything seemed unpredictable, which was in itself strange because it had to mean that everything to this point had been predictable. No, inevitable. Now it felt like anything could happen. Ronan's gaze was still focused down the dark passage, his eyes searching for Chainsaw and not finding her. He sneered, You can stay if you're too afraid. Gansey knew Ronan too well to let the barb sting. It's not myself I'm afraid for, Lynch. Reel it in. I think it's just trying to frighten us, Blue pointed out quite sensibly. If it really wanted to hurt us, it could have. He thought of Chainsaw's beak, poised so close to Ronan's eye. Adam, Gansey called down to the end of the line. Verdict? Adam was quiet as he weighed the options. His face was strange and delicate in the sharp light of Gansey's headbeam. Swiftly and without explanation, he reached out to touch the cavern wall. Although he was not a dream thing, he was now one of Caveswater's things, and it was hard not to see it in the way his fingers spidered across the wall and in the blackness of his eyes as they gazed at nothing. Blue said, Is he also possessed? None of them wanted to say it. Ronan lifted a finger to his lips. Adam seemed to listen to the walls. Who is this person? Is he still your friend? What did he give to Caveswater? What does he become? Why does terror grow so much better away from the sun? And then he said cautiously, I vote we go on. I think the frightening is a side effect, not the intention. I think Chainsaw is meant to lure us in. So they went on. Down and down, a more crooked path than the cavern in Caveswater. That passage had clearly been worn by water, while this one seemed unnatural, clawed out instead of formed. Ahead of them, Chainsaw cawed. It was a strange daytime sound to hear from the blackness ahead.
Chainsaw, Ronan called, voice rough.
Kira,
came the reply from not too far away. This was the bird's special name for Ronan. Thank goodness, Blue said. Ganzi at the head spotted her first, clinging to a ledge in the rock wall, scrabbling with one foot and flapping a little to keep her position. She didn't flee as he approached, and when he held out his arm to her, she flew to him, landing heavily. She seemed no worse the wear for her possession. He half turned. "Here's your bird, Lynch." Ronan's voice was odd.
"And there's your tomb, Ganzi."
He was looking past Ganzi. Ganzi turned. They stood at a stone door. It could have been a door to many things, but it was not. It was a carved tomb door. A stone-armored knight with hands crossed over his breast. His head rested on two ravens. His feet on fleur-de-lis. He held a shield. Glendower's shield. With three ravens. But this was wrong. It was not wrong because this was not how Ganzi would have expected Glendower's tomb to look. It was wrong because it was not supposed to happen this way. On this day, when his eyes hurt from sleeplessness and it drizzled outside, and it was a cave they'd only found a few days before. It was supposed to be a clue, and then another clue, and then another clue. It was not supposed to be 30 minutes of walking and a tomb door just like that. But it was. "It can't be," Adam said, finally from the back. "Do we just push it open?" Blue asked. She too sounded uncertain. This was not how it worked. It was the looking, not the finding. "I feel peculiar about this," Ganzi said finally. "It feels wrong for there to be no ceremony.
Be excited."
He turned back to the tomb door as the others drew close. Withdrawing his phone, he took several photos. Then after a pause, he typed in some location notes as well.
"God, Ganzi," Ronan said, but it had made Ganzi feel a little better about himself.
Carefully, he touched the seam around the effigy of the knight. The rock was cool, solid, real. His fingers came away dusted. This was happening. "I don't think it's sealed. I think it's just wedged in. Leverage, maybe?" Adam ran a finger along the edge. "Not much. It's not in very tightly." He thought about the fact of the three sleepers, one to be woken, one to stay asleep. Would they know if this was the one to leave undisturbed? Surely. Because if it was Mara's job to not wake this sleeper, there would be signs of her here. But he didn't know. There wasn't a way to know. Everything about this day was tinged by indecision and uncertainty. Suddenly the wall exploded in. As dust swirled in the air and they fell back coughing, Blue said, "Ronan Lynch!" Ronan rebalanced in the midst of the slowly clearing cloud. He had kicked the tomb door in. "That," he said thinly to no one in particular, "was for taking my bird." "Ronan, tell me now if I have to leash you, because I will," Ganzi said. Ronan immediately scoffed, but Ganzi pointed at him. "I'm serious. This is not yours alone. If this is a tomb, someone has been buried here, and you're going to give that person respect. Do not make me ask you again. For that matter, if any of us thinks they won't be able to contain themselves going forward, I suggest we turn around and come back another day, or the party in question waits out here." Ronan simmered. "Don't, Lynch," Ganzi said. "I've done this for 7 years, and this is the first time I'll have to leave a place looking worse because I've been there. Don't make me wish I'd come without you." This finally made it through the steel to Ronan's heart. His head ducked. In they went. It was like they had walked back into the past. The entire room was carved and painted. The colors were unfaded by the sun. Royal blue. Berry purple. Ruddy, bloody red. The carvings were sectioned into windows or arcades bounded by lilies and ravens, columns and pillars. Saints looked down, watchful and regal. Martyrs were speared and shot, burned and impassioned. Carved hounds chased hares, chased hounds again. On the wall hung a pair of gauntlets, a helmet, a breastplate. It was too much. Jesus, breathed Gansey. He stretched his fingers to touch the breastplate and then found he couldn't. He drew his hand back. He was not ready for it to be over. He was ready for it to be over. In the middle of the tomb was a stone coffin, waist high, the sides heavily carved. A stone effigy of Glendower lay on top, his helmeted head pillowed on three carved ravens. Do you remember saving my life? Blue said, look at all the birds. She trailed her flashlight over the walls and coffin. Everywhere the beam found feathers, wings garnishing the coffin, beaks plucking fruit, ravens sparring over shields. The light landed on Adam's face. His eyes were narrowed and wary. Beside him, Ronan looked strangely hostile, chainsaw hunched down on his shoulder. Blue took Gansey's phone from his pocket and took photos of the walls, the coffin, Gansey. Gansey's eyes dragged back to the coffin. Glendower's coffin. Is this really happening? Everything was sideways, mirrored, not exactly as he'd imagined it. He said, what are we doing? I think between all of us we should be able to leverage the lid off, Adam replied. But that wasn't what Gansey meant. He meant, what are we doing? We, of all people. With a little unfunny laugh, Blue said, my hands are clammy. They stood shoulder to shoulder. Gansey counted down, a breathless 3, 2, 1, and then they strained, unsuccessfully. It was like they were trying to shift the cavern itself. It's not even wiggling, Gansey said. Let's try the other side. As they moved to the other side and lifted, fingers barely finding purchase, lid unmoving, Gansey could not help but think of the old fairy tales. He imagined this wasn't an ordinary weight holding the lid down. Rather, it was unworthiness. They had not proven themselves in some way, and so Glendower was barred from them still. He was relieved somehow. That, at least, felt right. They didn't have heavy lifting equipment, Ronan said. But they could have had ropes and pulleys, Blue noted, or more people. Move over, I can't get my other hand on it. I'm not sure it'll make a difference, Gansey said, but they all pushed closer together. Her body was crushed against his. Ronan was crushed against Adam on the other side of him. There was silence except for their breathing. Blue said, 3, 2, and they lifted as one. The lid came off, suddenly weightless in comparison. It shifted and slid rapidly away. Grab it, Blue gasped. Then as Gansey started forward, no, wait, don't. There was a sick, wrenching sound as the lid scraped diagonally off the opposite side of the coffin and careened to the floor. It came to rest with a smaller but more destructive sound, like a fist hitting bone. It's cracked, Adam said. They drew closer. A coarse cloth hid the interior of the coffin from view. This is not right. Suddenly, Gansey felt deadly calm. This moment was so opposite to how his vision had portrayed it that his anxiety vanished. In its wake was nothing at all. He whisked the cloth free. None of them moved. At first, he didn't understand what he was looking at. The shape of it was alien. He couldn't put it together. He's face down, Blue suggested, but hesitantly. Because, of course, that was what it was. Now that she'd said it, a figure in a dark surcoat, purple or red, shoulder blades jutted toward them. A mass of dark hair, more than Gansey had expected, darker than he would have expected. His hands were bound behind his back. Bound? Bound. Something uneasy spasmed inside Gansey. Wrong, 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 wrong. Adam flicked the flashlight over the length of the coffin. Glendower's surcoat was hitched, exposing pale legs, bound at the knee, face down, hands tied, knees tied.
This was how they buried witches, suicides, criminals, prisoners. Gansey's hand hovered, pulled away. It wasn't that his courage had left him. His certainty had. This wasn't how it was supposed to be. Adam swept the flashlight again. Blue said, "Ah," and then changed her mind. The hair moved.
"Jesus shit, Mary fuck," said Ronan.
"Rats?" Adam suggested, a suggestion so hideous that both Gansey and Blue recoiled. Then the hair moved again, and a terrible sound issued from inside the coffin. A scream? A laugh. The shoulders jerked, shifting the body in the coffin so that the head could turn to see them. As Gansey caught a glimpse of the face, his heart sped and then stopped. He was relieved and horrified. It wasn't Glendower. He said, "It's a woman." 28. The woman didn't wait for them to free her. She wriggled and shimmied as they leapt back, and then she crashed down onto the floor, her hands and legs still bound. She landed right by Ronan's feet and snapped at his toes with a wild laugh. He and Chainsaw both flapped back. Blue exchanged a hectic look with Adam. And now the woman was singing.
"Queens and kings, kings and queens, blue lily, lily blue. Crowns and birds, swords and things, blue lily, lily blue."
She broke off with a hysterical laugh that perfectly matched the one that had come out of Chainsaw earlier. Rolling onto her back so that she was looking straight up at Ronan's disgusted features, she cooed, "Cut me free, Raven Prince."
"God," he said, "what are you?"
She laughed again.
"Oh, my rescuer came riding on a milk-white steed, and he said, 'Fair lady, I can bring you what you need.'"
Ronan wore an expression nearly identical to the one he'd worn when they picked up Mallory.
"She's crazy."
Gansey said very calmly, "Don't touch her." Before, when they thought it was Glendower, he'd seemed badly shaken, but now he had more than recovered. Blue's heart was still charging from when the coffin lid had fallen and when the woman had slithered out. It wasn't that she wanted Gansey to be the boss of her, but she was relieved that he was going to at least be the boss of this moment while she convinced her pulse to slow. He made his way around the coffin to where the woman lay. Now that she was face up, Blue could see that she was young, in her 20s perhaps. Her hair was enormous, raven black and wild, and her skin was as pale as the dead. Her surcoat was possibly the most incredible thing about her, because it was real. It did not look like a medieval costume. It looked like a real piece of clothing, because it was a real piece of clothing. Gansey leaned over her and asked in his polite, powerful way, "Who are you?"
"One wasn't enough," she shrieked. "They sent another. How many young men are in my chamber? Please tell me it's 3, the number of the divine. Are you going to untie me? It's very rude to keep a woman bound for any more than 2 or 3 or 7 generations."
Gansey's voice was even calmer, or perhaps it was unchanged, and only seemed calmer in comparison to her rising cadence. "Was it you who possessed my friend's raven?" She smiled at him and sang,
"All maidens young and fair, listen to your fathers."
"That's what I thought," Gansey said and straightened. He glanced to the others. "I don't think it's a wise idea to untie her."
"Ah, are you afraid?" she jeered. "Did you hear that I'm a witch? I have 3 breasts. I have a tail and horns. I am a giant down below. Oh, I'd be afraid of me too, young knight. I could get you pregnant. Run, run."
"Let's leave her," Ronan said. Gansey replied, "If we abandoned people in caves because they were crazy, you'd still be back in Caveswater. Give me your knife." Ronan said,
"I lost it."
"How did you—" "Never mind.
I have one, Blue said, feeling smug and useful. She produced her pink switchblade as the woman's gray eyes rolled up to look at her. Blue was rather afraid the woman would sing at her, but she just smiled, wide and knowing. I thought these were illegal, Gansey asked, kneeling beside the woman. He seemed so unperturbed now, as if he were calmly dealing with a wild animal. He sliced the straps around the woman's knees, but left her hands bound. They are, Blue answered Gansey, but she didn't look away from the woman's eyes. The woman was still smiling, smiling, as if she were waiting for Blue to break and look away. But Blue had good practice with this, thanks to Ronan. So she just kept frowning back. She wanted to ask the woman how she spoke English, and who she was, and was she okay after being in a box for quite a while, but the woman didn't really seem like a question-answering sort. I'm going to help you up, Gansey told the woman, but if you bite me, I'm putting you back in that coffin, do you understand?
Oh, you little rooster, said the woman. You remind me of my father, which is too bad.
Ronan was still staring at the woman aghast, so Blue hurried forward to help Gansey. The woman was both warmer and realer than Blue had imagined. She was very tall. Probably she'd eaten her greens. As Blue lifted her by an elbow, her enormously vertical nest of black hair tickled Blue's face, smelling of dirt and metal. She sang a little song about gifts and kings and internal organs. Okay, Gansey, Adam said warily. What's your plan now? We take her out, obviously, Gansey said. He turned to the woman. Unless you'd prefer to stay.
She rolled her head back so that her hair crushed down flat upon his shoulder and her face was inches from his.
Does the sun still exist?
The woman asked. Gansey used her hair to remove her head from his shoulder. As of a few hours ago.
Then take me, take me.
Adam was just shaking his head.
I cannot wait, Ronan said, to hear you explain this to Mallory.
The clouds had disappeared when they emerged, replaced by a sky so bright and blue and wind-seared that they all had to duck their heads against the grit hurled through the air. The wind was so ferocious that it snapped Blue's bangs painfully against her cheeks. A flock of crows or ravens flew high overhead, tossed and catapulted. Ronan held Chainsaw to his chest as if she were still a young raven protecting her from the wind. As they walked back toward the Diddley house, leaning into the gusts, rain spattered intermittently out of the cloudless sky. Adam reached to wipe it from his cheek and Blue said,
Adam, your face.
Adam pulled his finger away. The tip was red. Blue held out her hand to catch another stray drop. Red.
Blood. Ronan said, sounding factual rather than concerned.
Blue shuddered.
Whose?
Gansey studied a red spatter on the shoulder of his jacket, lips parted in astonishment.
Gansey, Adam called, pointing. Look.
They stopped in the middle of the beaten-down grass to gaze into the bright day sky. On the horizon, something glinted furiously, like the sun off a faraway plain. Blue shielded her eyes and saw that the object had a fiery tail. She couldn't quite imagine what it would be so visible in this bright daytime.
A plane crash? She asked.
A comet, Ronan said with certainty.
A comet? Echoed Adam. Blue was more afraid now than when they'd been in possible danger in the cave.
What were they doing?
It starts, the woman shouted. It starts again. Round and round and round.
She twirled in the field, her hands still bound behind her back. In the sunlight, the woman's regal beauty was more apparent. She had a rather large nose that was lovely in shape, sloping cheeks and forehead, dark quizzical eyebrows, and of course, that impossibly tall hair snarling out above her already tall body. Her purple-red robe was like a smear of paint in the field.
Gansey watched the heavenly body burn a slow trail across the blue. He said,
Signs and portents. A comet was seen in 1402, when Glendower was beginning to rise.
Ha! Shouted the woman.
Rise, rise, rise. Plenty of blood to be had then too. Plenty of blood to be had by all.
This last bit had fallen into song once more. Adam grabbed the woman's shoulder, stopping her from spinning. She rolled her body away from his hand like a drunk dancer and then fixed him with a wild-eyed gaze.
"You," she said, "are my least favorite. You remind me of both a man and a dog that I never liked."
"Noted," he replied. "Do we get a favor for waking you?" Of course, Blue thought stupidly. Of course we should have thought to ask that at once. It was all sleepers who supposedly granted a favor in the legends, not just Glendow. It seemed impossible that it wouldn't have occurred to all of them, but everything that had seemed obvious in theory was muddy and loud and frightening in practice. The woman shrieked like the crows overhead, and then she shrieked again, and then Blue realized it was laughter.
"A favor for waking me, little mongrel. I never slept."
Adam stared at her, raw, unmoving. He had let a single word, "mongrel," slice down to his spine. Gansey cut in, fearsomely polite. "We've been nothing but kind to you. His name is Adam Parrish, and that's what you can call him." She bowed cartoonishly to Gansey, stumbling to a knee with her hands still tied.
"Forgive me," she sneered. "My lord."
He pursed his lips, dismissive of the gesture. "What do you mean that you didn't sleep?"
"Go to sleep, my little daughter," said the woman sweetly. "Dream of war. Only I didn't. I couldn't. I've always been a restless sleeper."
She cast a dramatic pose, legs spread to balance herself. A drop of blood had peppered her cheek like a tear. In a high-pitched voice, she called,
"Help! Help! I'm not asleep! Come back! Come back!"
Lower, "Did you hear something?" "Only the sound of my blood throbbing in my manhood. Let's go."
Ronan's lip curled. Blue was pretty sure she'd heard that sound in the halls of her high school. She asked,
"Do you mean to say you've been awake for 600 years?
She chanted, "Give or take 200. "No wonder she's mad as a cow's tit," Ronan said. "Ronan," Gansey started, but then he clearly couldn't think of a good rebuke. "Let's go." Inside the house, Jesse Ditley peered at the woman. She was nearly as tall as he was.
"What's this?"
"Your curse," Gansey replied. Jesse looked dubious. He asked her,
"Now tell me this. Did you ever make my walls weep?"
"Only 3 or 5 times, she said. "Was it your father's blood that choked me to silence?"
"Did you kill my wife's cat?"
"That," she sang, "was an accident. Was it your grandfather's blood before that?"
"Take her out of my house," Jesse said. "Please."
As the boys bundled the woman out the other side of the house, Mallory and the dog hurrying after, Blue stayed behind. She stood by Jesse as he drew aside a shabby curtain to watch the boys persuading the woman to get into the Suburban. Blue got a good glimpse of her biting the dog. She felt a little less afraid now that she was no longer standing right next to the woman, although she couldn't stop seeing Chainsaw's beak eerily parted in false song, or forget the jump of her heart when the body first moved within the coffin. This crooked enchantment felt nothing like Caveswater's organic magic.
"That one's not all there,"
Blue said.
"She's been awake for hundreds of years. Somehow when a Ditley died in the cave, it must have shut her up for a little bit. But we have her now. She was the curse. You don't have to go into the cave and die now."
Jesse let the curtain fall back into place.
"Do you reckon you can lose a curse as easy as that?"
"Maybe. Probably. She's been in there for a really long time," Blue said. "As long as there have been Ditleys here. You heard her say she did those things."
"But what are you going to do with her?"
"I don't know. Something." She patted his arm. "You should call your wife or your dog."
Jesse scratched his chest.
"You really are a very good kind of aunt."
They shook hands. Blue saw him watching out the window as they left. They took the woman to 300 Fox Way, of course, where they found an extremely unimpressed Calla and a rather alarmed-looking Jimmy and a fascinated Orla.
Persephone took one look at the woman, nodded firmly, and then disappeared upstairs. Mallory drank footy tea in the reading room. Adam and Ronan lurked in the hall, eavesdropping, too cowardly to face Calla's wrath. And Calla was indeed in fine form. She barked,
"Do you remember how I said that there were three sleepers and Mora's job was to not wake one of them and your job was to wake one of the others? Remember how I didn't say anything about the other one? I did not mean bring her to my kitchen."
Blue felt equal parts relief and annoyance. The former, because she had been worried that the woman might have been the sleeper that was not to be woken. The latter, because they were in trouble. She demanded, "Where else are we supposed to take her? Mom would have said to bring her here."
"Your mother has no common sense. We're not a halfway home."
Calla walked right up to the woman, who gazed around the kitchen with something between bewilderment and regal insanity.
"What's your name?"
"My name is that of all women," the woman replied. "Sorrow."
One of Calla's eyebrows momentarily considered punching the woman. She said,
"Why didn't you just leave her?"
From the hall, Ronan shot a superior look at Gansey. "Look, I understand she can't stay here," Gansey said, "but she's clearly more like you than like..." Calla's expression turned volcanic.
"Like what, sir? Like you, Richard Gansey? Is that what you were going to say? You think she's going to get her crazy on you, but we're immune? Well, you've got another think coming, mister."
Gansey blinked rapidly. A slow smile spread over the woman's face.
"He's not wrong, witch."
Lava spilled over Calla's eyelids. "What did you just call me?"
The woman laughed and sang, "Blue lily, lily blue, you and I." Both Blue and Calla scowled at the eerily familiar words. This woman must have been the one who had possessed Noah, just as she had possessed Chainsaw. Blue hoped this skill didn't extend beyond dream birds and dead boys. "It's not too late to put her back," Ronan said.
"You too,"
roared Calla. Both Adam and Ronan winced.
"Go to the store and get some supplies for her."
Adam and Ronan exchanged a wide-eyed look. Adam's look said, "What does that mean?" And Ronan said, "I don't care. Let's get out of here before she changes her mind." Gansey frowned after them as they scrambled to the front door. Persephone reappeared then, holding the sweater with mismatched arms. She peered at the woman in an appraising sort of way. It would have seemed rude if it hadn't been Persephone. The woman appraised her back, with a lot more of the whites of her eyes showing. Finally, Persephone seemed satisfied. She offered up the sweater.
"I made you this. Try it. Oh, why haven't they untied you yet?"
"We thought she might be dangerous," Gansey answered lamely. Persephone cocked her head at him.
"And you thought tying her hands would change that?"
He turned to Blue for help. "She's an uncooperative witness," Blue provided.
"This isn't how we treat guests," Persephone said, faintly chastising.
Calla retorted,
"I was unaware she was a guest."
"Well, I was expecting her," Persephone said.
She paused.
"I think. We'll see if the sweater fits."
Gansey cut his eyes over to Blue. She shook her head.
"You should untie me, little lily,"
the woman said to Blue,
"with your little lily knife. It would be very fitting and circular."
"Why would it be fitting and circular?" Blue asked warily.
"Because your father is the one who tied me in the first place. Oh, men."
Blue was abruptly awake. She had been awake before, but she was now so much more than she had been the second before that she felt as if she had been sleeping.
Her father.
The woman was suddenly in her face, hands still tied behind her back.
"Oh, yes. Suitable punishment," he said. "Artemis."
She laughed at the shocked faces in the room.
"Oh, the things I know. Behold the way in which it glows within a ring of water, within a moat, upon a lake, all in a ring of water."
Earlier that year, when Blue had first met the boys, there had been a moment when she had been suddenly struck by how she was being drawn into their tangled lives. Now she realized that she had never been drawn in. She had been there all along, together with this woman and all the other women at Foxway, and maybe even Mallory and his dog. They were not creating a mess. They were just slowly illuminating the shape of it. With a frown, Blue took out the switchblade. Taking care not to cut herself or the woman's pale white skin, she sliced the worn bonds at her wrists. Okay, talk. The woman stretched her arms up and out, her face rapturous. She spun and spun, knocking glasses off the table and smashing her hands into the complicated light fixture hanging over the kitchen table. She tripped over shoes and kept going, laughing and laughing, ever more hysterical. When she stopped, her eyes were electric and unhinged. "My name," she said, "is Gwynthlian." "Oh," said Gansey in a very small voice. "Yes, little knight. I thought you knew."
"Knew what?" Calla asked suspiciously.
Gansey's expression was troubled. "You're Owen Glendower's daughter."
29. "I don't even know what to get. A kennel?" Ronan asked.
Adam didn't reply. They were in a large, glowing big box store looking at toiletries. He picked up a bottle of shampoo and put it back down. His clothing was still flecked with blood from the apocalyptic drizzle, and his soul still smarted from the mongrel comment. Gwynthlian, Gansey had texted Ronan her identity, had been in a cave for 600 years and had gotten his number at once. How? Ronan picked up a bottle of shampoo and tossed it in the cart Adam pushed. "That one's $14, Adam said. He found it impossible to turn off the part of his brain that added up the sum of groceries. Perhaps this was what Gwynthlian could see in the furrow of his eyebrows. The other boy didn't even turn around.
"What else? Flea collar?"
"He already did a dog joke with kennel."
"So I did, Parrish."
He continued down the aisle, shoulders square, chin tilted haughtily. He did not look like he was shopping. He looked like he was committing larceny. He swept some toothpaste into the basket.
"Which toothbrush? This one looks fast."
He sent it plummeting in with the other supplies. The discovery of Gwynthlian was doing odd things to Adam's brain. Disbelief shouldn't have been an option after all of the things that had happened with the ley line and Caveswater, but Adam realized that he still hadn't truly believed that Glendower might still be sleeping under a mountain somewhere. And yet here was Gwynthlian, buried in the same legendary way. His final skepticism had been taken from him. "What do we do now?" Adam asked.
"Get a doghouse." "Damn, you're right. I really can't think of another joke."
"I mean, now that we have Gwynthlian."
Ronan made a sound that indicated he didn't find this line of thought interesting. "Do what we were doing before. She doesn't matter."
"Everything matters," Adam replied, recalling his sessions with Persephone. He contemplated adding deodorant to the cart, but he wasn't sure if there was any point getting it for someone who had been born before it was invented. "Gansey wants Glendower. She's not Glendower." Ronan started to say something, and then didn't. He hurled a bottle of shave cream into the cart, but no razor. It was possible it was for him, not Gwynthlian.
"I'm not sure we shouldn't stop while we're ahead anyway. We have Caveswater. Why do we need Glendower?"
Adam thought of the vision of Gansey dying on the ground. He said, "I want the favor." Ronan stopped so abruptly in the middle of the aisle that Adam nearly ran the cart into the back of his legs. The six items in the bottom skittered forward.
"Come on, Parrish. You still think you need that?"
"I don't question the things that motor..."
"Blah, blah, blah. Right, I know. Hey, look at that," Ronan said.
The two of them observed a beautiful woman standing by the garden section, attended by three male store workers. Her cart was full of tarps and hedge trimmers and various things that looked as if they might be easily weaponized. The men held shovels and flagpoles that didn't fit in the cart. They seemed very eager to help. It was Piper Greenmantle. Adam said wryly, "She doesn't strike me as your type."
Ronan hissed, "That's Greenmantle's wife."
"How do you know what she looks like?"
"Oh, please. Now that's what we should be thinking about. Have you researched him yet?"
"No," Adam said, but it was a lie. It was difficult for him to ignore a question once it had been posed, and Greenmantle was a bigger question than most. He admitted, "Some?"
"A lot," Ronan translated, and he was right, because strangely enough, Ronan knew a great deal about how Adam worked.
It was possible Adam had always been aware of this, but had preferred to consider himself, particularly the more unsightly parts of himself, impenetrable. With a last glance at the blonder Greenmantle, they made their way through the checkout line. Ronan swiped a card without even looking at the total. One day, one day, one day. And then they headed back out into the bright afternoon. At the curb, Adam realized he was still pushing the cart with its single bag nestled in the corner. He wondered if they were supposed to have gotten more things, but he couldn't imagine what they would have been. Ronan pointed at the cart.
"Get in there."
"What?" He just continued pointing. Adam said, "Give me a break. This is a public parking lot."
"Don't make this ugly, Parrish."
As an old lady headed past them, Adam sighed and climbed into the basket of the shopping cart. He drew his knees up so that he would fit. He was full of the knowledge that this was probably going to end with scabs. Ronan gripped the handle with the skittish concentration of a motorcycle racer and eyed the line between them and the BMW parked on the far side of the lot.
"What do you think the grade is on this parking lot?"
"C plus, maybe B. Oh, I don't know, 10 degrees? Adam held the sides of the cart and then thought better of it. He held himself instead.
With a savage smile, Ronan shoved the cart off the curb and belted toward the BMW. As they picked up speed, Ronan called out a joyful and awful swear and then jumped onto the back of the cart himself.
As they hurtled toward the BMW, Adam realized that Ronan, as usual, had no intention of stopping before something bad happened. He cupped a hand over his nose just as they glanced off the side of the BMW. The unseated cart wobbled once, twice, and then tipped catastrophically onto its side. It kept skidding, the boys skidding along with it. The three of them came to a stop.
"Oh, God," Adam said, touching the road burn on his elbow. It wasn't that bad, really. "God, God, I can feel my teeth."
Ronan lay on his back a few feet away. A box of toothpaste rested on his chest and the cart keeled beside him. He looked profoundly happy.
"You should tell me what you found out about Greenmantle," Ronan said, "so that I can get started on my dreaming."
Adam picked himself up before he got driven over.
"When?"
Ronan grinned. 30.
"This house is lovely. So many walls. So, so many walls," Mallory said, as Blue entered the living room a little later. The cushions of the couch ate him gratefully.
The dog lay stiffly on the floor beside the couch, crossing his paws and looking generally judgmental. Behind the closed door of the reading room, the murmur of Gansey's voice rose briefly before being buried by Calla's. They were fighting with Persephone, or talking while she was in the same room with them. It was hard to tell the difference.
"Thanks," said Blue. "Where is that insane woman?"
Blue had just finished hauling all Neve's things off the mattress in the attic so that Gwynthlian could stay up there. Her hands still smelled like the herbs Neve had used for her divination, and the herbs Jimmy had used to try to vanquish the herbs Neve had used for divination.
"She's up in the attic, I guess. Do you really think she's Glendower's daughter?"
"I see no reason to disbelieve," Mallory said.
"She does seem to be outfitted in a period dress. It's rather a lot to take in. It's a pity one can't publish it in a journal."
"Well, I suppose one could if one wanted his career to be over in a conclusive way."
"I wish she would just talk straight," Blue said. "She says my father was the one who tied her up and put her to sleep, only she told us that she never slept. But that's impossible, isn't it? How can you just be alive and awake for 600 years?
The dog gave Blue a thin, wry look that indicated he believed that was how Gwynthlian had come to be the way that she was.
"It seems likely that this Artemis was also the individual who sent Glendower to sleep," Mallory observed. "I don't mean to be rude, but the idea that he also fathered you strains the credulity, rather."
"Rather," Blue echoed. She didn't have an emotional stake in it either way. Her father had always been a stranger to her, and whether or not he also turned out to be a 600-year-old crazy person didn't change that. It was interesting that Gwynthlian had been tied up and sent to sleep by someone named Artemis, and interesting that this Artemis person apparently looked a lot like Blue, and interesting that Mora had also said that Blue's father was named Artemis, but interesting wouldn't find Mora.
"Although one considers that tapestry," Mallory said.
The old tapestry from the flooded barn. Blue saw it again. Her three faces, her red hands. "What does one consider about it?"
"One doesn't know. Is she staying here?" Mallory asked.
"I guess. For now. Probably she'll kill us all in our beds, no matter what Persephone says."
"I think it's wise that she stays here," Mallory said. "She belongs here."
Blue blinked at him. Although the crotchety professor had grown on her since she'd first met him, she certainly wouldn't have pegged him for the sort to consider other people enough to be able to offer interpersonal insight.
"Would you like to know what service the dog provides?" he asked.
This didn't seem to have any bearing on his previous statement, but Blue's curiosity devoured her. With restraint, she replied, "Oh, well, I don't want you to feel uncomfortable."
"I feel uncomfortable all the time, Jane," Mallory said. "That's what the dog is for. The dog is a psychiatric dog. The dog is trained so that if the dog senses I am having anxiety, he does something to improve the situation. Such as sit beside me, or lie on my chest, or place my hand in his mouth."
"Are you anxious a lot?"
"It's a terrible word, anxious. It makes one think of wringing hands and hysteria and bodices. Rather, I simply don't care for people, because people, my, they are going at it, aren't they?"
This was because Calla had just shouted in the other room,
"Don't give me that vacuous prep boy stare."
Blue had previously been pleased to not be looped into the serious discussion in the reading room, but now she was reconsidering. Mallory continued,
"I was paired with the dog directly before this trip, and I must say I did not imagine it would be so challenging to travel with a canine. Not only was it quite a thing to find a place for the dog to relieve himself, the dog was constantly trying to lie on my chest while I was standing in that dreadful security line."
The dog did not look sorry. Mallory continued,
"It is not the outside of people that bothers me, but the inside. Ever since I was a child, I have been able to see auras or what have you, personhood. And if the person..."
"Wait, did you say you could see auras?"
"Jane, I didn't expect you to be judgmental of all people."
Blue was well familiar with the idea of auras, energy fields that surrounded all living objects. Orla had gone through a period in her teens of telling everyone what their auras said about them. She had told Blue that her aura had meant she was short. She had been a pretty awful teenager. "I wasn't judging," she assured Mallory. "I was clarifying. This relates to the dog because..."
"Because when people are too close to me, their auras touch me. And if too many auras touch me, it confuses me and makes me what doctors have foolishly called anxious. Doctors. Fools. I don't know if Ganzi ever told you how my mother was murdered by the British healthcare system."
"Oh, yes," Blue lied swiftly. She was very interested in hearing about how Mallory saw auras, which was firmly in her circle of interests, and less interested in hearing about deaths of mothers, which was decidedly outside of her circle of interests.
"It's a shocking story," Mallory said with some relish.
Then, because of Blue's face or stature, he told her the story. He finished with,
"And I could see her aura slowly vanish. So you see, this is how I know that Gwynthlian belongs in a place like this."
Blue dragged an expression back onto her face. Hold on. What? I missed something in here?
Her aura is like yours. It's blue, he said. The clairvoyant aura.
Is it? She was going to be extremely annoyed if this was how she had gotten her name, like naming a puppy Fluffy.
That color of aura belongs to those who can pierce the veil.
She decided that telling him that she couldn't, in fact, pierce the veil would only prolong the conversation.
It's why I was originally drawn to Ganzi, Mallory continued. Despite his mercurial personality, he has a very pleasant and neutral aura. I don't feel like I am with another person when I am with him. He doesn't take from me. He is a little louder now, but not very much.
Blue had only a very limited understanding of what mercurial meant, and that limited understanding was having a very bad time of trying to apply it to Ganzi. She asked, what was he like back then?
They were glorious days, Mallory replied. Then after a pause he added, except for when they weren't.
He was smaller then. The way he said smaller made it seem as if he wasn't talking about height, and Blue thought she knew what he meant. Mallory continued,
he was still trying to prove that he hadn't just hallucinated. He was still quite obsessed with the event itself. He seems to have grown out of that, fortunate for him.
The event? The stinging? The death, I mean?
Yes, Jane, the death. He puzzled it over all the time. He was always drawing bees and hornets and stuff and such. Got screaming nightmares over it. He had to get his own place, since I couldn't sleep with it, as you might well imagine. Sometimes these fits would happen during the day, too. We'd just be toddling through some riding path in Leicestershire, and next thing I knew he'd be on the ground clawing his face like a mental patient. I let him be, though, and he'd run his course and be fine like nothing had happened.
How terrible, whispered Blue. She imagined that easy smile Ganzi had learned to throw up over his true face. With shame, she recalled how she had once wondered what would have made a boy like him, a boy with everything, ever learn such a skill. How unfair she'd been to assume love and money would preclude pain and hardship. She thought of their disagreement in the car the night before with some guilt. Mallory hadn't seemed to hear her.
Such a researcher, though. Such a keen nose for hidden things. You can't train that. You have to be born with it.
She heard Ganzi's voice in the cave, hollow and afraid. Hornets. She shivered.
Of course, then he just went one day, Mallory mused.
What? Blue focused abruptly.
I should not have been surprised, the professor said in an offhand voice. I knew he was a great traveler, but we were not truly done researching, I thought. We had a bit of a toss-up, patched it up, but then one morning he was just gone.
Gone how? The dog had climbed onto Mallory's chest and now licked his chin. Mallory didn't push him away.
Gone. His things, his bags. He left much of it behind, what he didn't need. But he never returned. It was months before he called me again, like nothing had happened.
It was hard to imagine Ganzi abandoning anything that way. All around him were things he clung to ferociously. He didn't leave a note or anything?
Just gone, Mallory said. After that, his family called me sometimes, trying to find out where he'd gone.
His family? She felt like she was being told a story about a different person.
Yes, I told them what I could, of course, but I didn't really know. It was Mexico before he came to me, then Iceland after, I think, before the States. I doubt I know the half of it still. He picked himself up and moved so easily, so quickly. He had done it so many times before England, Jane, and it was old hat to him.
Past conversations were slowly realigning in Blue's head, taking on new shades of meaning as they did. She recalled one charged night on the side of a mountain, looking down at Henrietta lit like a fairy village. "Home," he'd said, like it pained him, like he couldn't believe it. It wasn't exactly like the story Mallory had just told conflicted with the Gansey she knew. It was more like the Gansey she'd seen was a partial truth. It was cowardice and stupidity, Gansey said from the doorway. He leaned on the door jamb, hands in pockets, as he often did. I didn't like goodbyes, so I just abstained,